Welcome to International Edition, where we take a closer look at stories of the day, social media, and entertainment. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a live update on the Boston bombing sentencing. We hear reaction to new allegations of U.S. spying. An expert will address possible advances against ISIS in Syria. And we meet an Italian immigrant to the U.S. who loves to share his cuisine.
I learned how to do penne arrabbiata for the first time without burning the garlic or the entire kitchen.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. A big story is emerging in France. French President François Hollande's office says allegations the United States eavesdropped on his phone calls and those of his two predecessors. A judge in the U.S. city of Boston has been listening to statements from victims of the Boston Marathon bombing. The judge will then formally impose the death sentence recommended by a jury against Zokhar Tsarnaev for the 2013 attack that killed three people and wounded 264 others. Sitting in the courtroom is our own Fatima Zanarov, and she joins us now on the line, live from Boston. Fatima, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First of all, what was said today in the solemn courtroom?
In the courtroom, the victims had an opportunity to address directly Zokhar Tsarnaev, the defendant, who seemed very relaxed. He entered the room and joked and smiled, chatting with his lawyers. And you are a coward and a liar, trying to hide your own guilt behind the body of your dead brother, said one of the victims, the mother of Christine Campbell, who died during the attack, Judith Campbell. And she said, we watched you for a few months during this trial here in the courtroom. You showed no remorse, you showed no mercy when listening to our tragic stories. Today is your last chance, she said. And she also thanked all the jurors for their verdict. There was another opinion, though. It was the family of Richards. Bill Richards spoke on behalf of himself and his wife. He was very emotional. Everybody was very emotional today. And Bill Richards said that the family supported the life in a prison sentence. They were hoping that Zokhar Tsarnaev gets a chance to spend his life in prison to think and understand what he has done to so many people and ask for forgiveness. Bill Richards said, you didn't ask for forgiveness. You didn't show remorse. And there is no redemption if you don't ask for forgiveness. And he also called upon Zokhar Tsarnaev to use today's last chance to speak up his mind. Very emotional statements from all the victims today. There was a mother whose sons lost their legs, and there was Heather Ebert, who spoke on behalf of the whole nation, and she said that you brought terror and death. You brought here hatred. You were hoping to break the American spirit, but you failed. And many others, victims said the same. You failed. You failed your jihadi mission. And the last victim to testify today was Rebecca Gregory. And she said that she's not broken as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Fatima. It sounds like a very stressful day. We appreciate your report. Thank you.
Thank you.
A big story is emerging in France. French President François Hollande's office says allegations the United States eavesdropped on his phone calls and those of his two predecessors are unacceptable, and he adds that France will not tolerate anything that threatens its security. For more on this story, I'm joined by my colleague Sarah Williams. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Susan.
So tell us about what happened.
Well, WikiLeaks released documents saying that the U.S. National Security Agency spied on the past three French presidents. Now, in addition to Mr. Hollande, that would be Jacques Chirac and Nicolas Sarkozy. Now, just 2 years ago, WikiLeaks reported that the NSA had wiretapped German Chancellor Angela Merkel's private phone. That report sparked a political scandal in Germany, and it prompted an official inquiry. I spoke with Dominique Moisy. He's a senior advisor to the French Institute for International Relations in Paris. He describes the French reaction to the most recent disclosure.
Well, not surprised, because we knew, given the fact that Chancellor Angela Merkel was listened to, that the French presidents also were of interest for the NSA, but at the same time, a sense of shock and displeasure. This is not a way to treat an ally. And so, yes, a feeling of what's gone wrong with America, what has happened to a system that seems to be escaping any diplomatic common sense. You don't want to show your ally that you distrust them so much, that you want to make sure that you know whatever they be saying.
Well, Sarah, what happens now?
I asked Mr. Moisy about that.
Well, France will call for an apology, and a formal one would be better than a subdued private one. And I think apologies are needed. And then, of course, France and the United States need each other too much. They will remain close friends and ally. But this will leave a little scar. And this was, to say the least, unwelcome.
That's Dominique Moisy, the senior advisor to the French Institute for International Relations. He was speaking from Paris.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for that.
You're welcome.
The White House did not address whether the U.S. had monitored Mr. Hollande or his predecessors in the past, but stressed that he is not targeting Mr. Hollande's communications and wouldn't do so. NSA spokesman Ned Price said the Obama administration does not conduct any foreign intelligence surveillance unless there is a specific and validated national security purpose, a standard, he said, applied to both world leaders and ordinary citizens. Well, Michael Lippin is here with reaction that he's found on the web. Michael, what's going on?
Hi, Susan. Well, yes, the WikiLeaks organization that releases secret documents from the U.S. and other nations from time to time has done pretty well in terms of publicity for this latest leak about alleged U.S. spying on France. The Twitter analytics site Topsy shows that WikiLeaks has been mentioned 46,000 times on Twitter in the past day, and that's the most daily tweets for the past month. One of those tweets comes from The Economist magazine. And The Economist linked to its latest report on the issue headlined, WikiLeaks releases evidence of American spying. The French say they are shocked. Okay, so The Economist is being a little sarcastic there. Its article makes the point that French President Hollande expressed similar shock 2 years ago after a previous leak of documents purported to detail U.S. spying on European leaders. But the article says Mr. Hollande only made a minor fuss about that case and soon turned his attention to other matters, with the implication being that the same may happen with this latest leak. Another tweet about WikiLeaks comes from the Jerusalem Post newspaper, and that focuses on one of the revelations in the new WikiLeaks documents. The JPost website tweeted this headline, "Leaked documents show that France sought to exclude world powers from fresh Israeli-Palestinian talks." So the JPost story says that the leaked U.S. diplomatic cables allegedly show that the U.S. National Security Agency overheard former French President Nicolas Sarkozy trying to take the lead in peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians with a 2011 initiative. The article also says Mr. Sarkozy wanted to exclude members of the Middle East Peace Quartet from that initiative so that he could lead it himself. Susan?
Thank you very much, Michael. Well, President Barack Obama has ordered an extensive reform of U.S. policies about dealing with hostage takers, and he pledged the government will use all instruments of national power to recover Americans being held prisoner abroad by terrorists. All this just came down a little while ago, and we have on the line live White House correspondent Arup Pandey. Welcome, Arup.
Thank you so much.
What did the president have to say about all this?
Well, the main takeaway from this is, first of all, it was a review undertaken when families who are clearly frustrated about the process right now. They've complained that there's a lack of coordination between different federal agencies. Some of them, for example, wanted to perhaps pay a ransom to those holding their loved ones, but were told by the Department of State that if they did, they would be criminally prosecuted. But then the DOJ would say no, or the FBI would say no, we'll help you coordinate the release. So they're getting mixed messages. They felt like there were too many people involved, and they just really weren't feeling like they were getting the communication and support from the federal government that they needed in order to get their loved ones back. So the president ordered this hostage policy review, and after 6 months and consulting with the families and consulting with different members of federal agencies, he came up with this plan. And the takeaway is this. The main takeaway is that families who want to pursue and perhaps pay ransom to those who are holding their loved ones overseas will not be criminally prosecuted. The president reaffirmed that the U.S. government will continue its policy of not paying ransom to get back hostages and basically continue with the no concessions to terrorists. But families who do pursue that option will be supported by federal agencies, whether it be coordinating communication between those holding the hostages and the family members, but they will not be penalized for pursuing whatever option that they want to get their loved ones back.
And
the president also announced the creation of a fusion cell, which basically would integrate all these different agencies, whether it be the FBI or the State Department or the Department of Justice, so that everyone is working together and the response is coordinated and the families feel like they're dealing with one central entity as opposed to several different agencies at once.
This is controversial because some people feel that if you give money to hostage takers, it will encourage more hostage taking.
And that's exactly what the president said today. He said that is exactly why he reaffirmed the no concessions policy, that he believes that paying ransoms to terrorists who are holding American hostages overseas puts more American lives in danger. But he said he does understand families need to pursue whatever options they need to pursue. So he said that the government will support them. I mean, it basically comes down to the frustrations from these families who say they weren't being supported or helped properly or given mixed messages. So he's reassuring them that we're here, we stand by you. He acknowledged that the government has not always been as helpful as it possibly could, and that things are going to change, and that's basically what he came away with, what we came away with today during his statement regarding this, like I said, this change, and he issued an executive order today talking about some of the changes and the creation of this fusion cell. So it's going to be a more coordinated response from the federal government.
Well, thank you very much, Aru, for reporting from the White House for us. Have a nice day. Our listeners are tuned to VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
U.S. and Japanese researchers have discovered 854 ultra-dark galaxies located within the Coma Cluster, about 321 million light-years from Earth. Dark galaxies contain or are composed of dark matter that cannot be seen by telescopes. The researchers say that these galaxies became dark after they lost gas needed to create new stars sometime during or after their formation billions of years ago. While these newly discovered galaxies do contain some visible light, the researchers say that it only amounts to about 1% or less of the total mass of each galaxy. The remaining 99% of the total mass is thought to be dark matter. While dark matter can't be seen, its existence can be implied from the gravitational effect it has on visible matter. The astronomers were able to make their discovery by analyzing archival data from Hawaii's Subaru Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Obama administration is taking partial credit for recent gains by Kurdish forces in northern Syria against Islamic State fighters. My colleague Victor Beatty has been following this story and joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Thank you, Susan. White House spokesman Josh Earnest on Tuesday told reporters that it goes back to the decision by President Obama to supply Kurds and a long struggle to take the Syrian border town of Kobani in January.
We have seen important progress against ISIL in northeast Syria. Much of that progress is actually related to an early decision that the administration, that the president made, to weigh in heavily in support of anti-ISIL forces in Kobani. There was a decision that the president made to airdrop some military equipment inside of Kobani to resupply those forces that were surrounded and under siege by ISIL forces in the area. There also was an effort by the United States and our coalition partners to encourage Turkey to provide safe passage to some anti-ISIL fighters to enter the country and to reinforce those fighters in Kobani. Since that time, we have seen those forces that started in Kobani move eastward and to push back ISIL. And there have been extensive military strikes, airstrikes that have been carried out by the United States and our coalition partners in the region as well. And this is, I think, an indication of how critically important it is for the United States to have a capable, willing, and effective partner fighting ISIL on the ground.
On Tuesday, Kurdish-led forces claimed to have captured Ain Issa, about 50 kilometers north of Raqqa, the capital of the self-declared IS caliphate. They say they captured a nearby military base late Monday following last week's ouster of IS fighters from the border town of Tal Abyad. The Kurds, known as YPG, or People's Protection Units, have been helped by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes. However, a U.S. defense spokesman says he cannot verify the latest Kurdish claim, but said Kurdish success is making it harder for the IS group to keep up its steady flow of arms and recruits from Turkey. I spoke to RAND Corporation Middle East analyst Ben Connable. He told me if the latest Kurdish claim is true, it's another significant victory against IS, although it could complicate Syria's political future.
I think the problem is that we're starting to see the expansion of a Kurdish north, and that is going to make a resolution of the Syrian problem all the more difficult, because if the Kurds do carve out their own space in northern Syria, there are going to be a considerable number of other Syrians who are not going to be happy with it.
Among all the reports I read, there is no indication of what their ultimate objective is. They're considered Sunni and moderate. What ultimately do you think is their goal?
Well, I think they are trying to probably carve out their own territory, which makes a lot of sense. And probably from a political standpoint, from a security standpoint, I think if anybody were in their shoes, they would probably be doing the same thing. The question is, how is that going to resolve whatever other issues are there? And are they doing any kind of ethnic cleansing that we've seen in northern Iraq and southern Iraq in Syria? I think there haven't been any significant reports of that I've seen. But that's something we need to watch out for.
What is their key to success, do you think?
Well, it's the small unit cohesion and fighting power that's generated by people who want to fight and win. I think they're motivated by the fact that they've lost their home territory. Their families were turned into displaced persons, and they believe that they're fighting for an eventual Kurdish homeland. That kind of fighting power gives you great strength. And we see on the other end, across the border in Iraq, the Iraqi army not doing well, really not having much to fight for. Not really believing in certainly the fight that's taking place in the Sunni areas.
Connable says advances by the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front in northwestern Syria is less good news for both the Syrian people and the West.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan, thank you.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Thank you. Classical music is showing a way for Jews and Arabs to become friends. Some of the project's musicians came to New York recently to perform, as we hear from VOA's Carolyn Weaver.
These young musicians, two Israeli Jews, two Israeli Arabs, are in New York to perform as the Polyphony Quartet, an ensemble created by the Israel-based Polyphony Foundation. Revital Bandersky and Shar Hayat are violinists and Jewish. Faris Mashour, a violinist and violist, is a Palestinian Christian, and Mahdi Saadi, a cellist, is Muslim. Polyphony began in 2006 as a small school in Nazareth to bring classical music to Arab children, says founder and music director Nabil Aboud Ashkar.
There was never a real proper opportunities for young Arab children to learn classical music. And this is what we were able to change. We showed everyone that there's no reason why an Arab kid shouldn't be able to play classical music on a high standard.
The school flourished as teachers, most of them Israeli Jews, drove 2 hours from Tel Aviv to teach the children. Out of that, Polyphony was formed to further music education and to bring together young Palestinian classical music students to perform with their Jewish peers. Friendships developed among people who would otherwise have no reason to meet.
Polyphony changed all my thinking and how I see people, how to accept them, and how to be accepted also. Yeah, I never had a Jewish friend before.
That's Carolyn Weaver reporting. I'm sorry, because of our two breaking news reports, we were unable to bring you the Italian food story today. It's a good one. We'll plan on bringing it to you tomorrow at this time. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington, inviting you to join us anytime on the web at voanews.com. Just go up to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition and listen to your heart's content. Thanks again for joining us. Have a good day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sexual violence and conflict is an atrocity that stands in the way of peace, prosperity, and gender equality. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL is making life hell for women and girls. The situation is especially grim for members of minority populations. Thousands of girls and women were abducted by ISIL last summer. Many, including girls as young as 7 or 8, were repeatedly raped and forced to marry ISIL fighters. Others have been sold as slaves. The United States is providing both humanitarian aid and other kinds of assistance. But the international community needs to do more to protect and better serve women and girls affected by the conflict. For example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, sexual violence has become a weapon that destroys lives, fuels conflict, and stands in the way of lasting peace. The U.S. is working to build a coherent approach to justice. Judges are holding open trials in local areas so witnesses can testify in their own communities. In turn, those communities can see firsthand that sexual violence will not go unpunished and that impunity will not be tolerated. Sexual violence and conflict continues to be a global problem that we need to address. In many headlines, women are portrayed as victims. And while there's no doubt that far too many women and girls are survivors of gender-based violence, it's not the whole story. Women are also incredible agents of change. They wield influence in their communities. They bring unique insights to decision-making tables. They increase the effectiveness of government. Gender-based violence, including sexual violence and conflict, holds women and girls back from participating fully in society. The repercussions negatively impact whole communities, halting development and leading to poorer educational, health, and economic outcomes. Tackling gender-based violence is crucial if we hope to unleash women's and girls' full potential and promote stability and economic growth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.